Good evening. This is Life Rattle, the story show. I'm your host, John Dunford. Tonight's program, Life Rattle number 1279, features two stories by new Life Rattle writer, Rohan El-Shabessy. Rohan El-Shabessy grew up in Cairo, Egypt, the firstborn in a comparatively liberal and very patriotic Egyptian family. She moved with her mother and younger brother to Canada in 2009 and enrolled in university, where she managed to complete a double major with half her brain on campus and the other half focused on her home country. Living between two cultures and countries has greatly influenced Rohan's life. She explains that the experience has given her so much more to consider and so much more to express through her art making, whether writing a story, a melody, a song, or working on a painting. Rohan El-Shabessy believes in the arts, possibly more than anything else that she could choose to believe in. It should come as no surprise that Rohan uses words to paint a picture. She is, after all, a visual artist. She wears her heart on her sleeve, unafraid to explore the tangled, conflicting emotions that make us human. She deftly weaves in and out of facts and feelings. In tonight's first story, I Was Brave, our narrator, after a romantic stroll through a park with a young man, later speaks about the status of their growing relationship over Skype. Let's listen now as Rohan El-Shabessy reads her story, I Was Brave, tonight on Life Rattle.
I Was Brave by Rohan El-Shabessy. Do you have any allergies? Asked the nurse. Taking medication? Not that I know of, no, I reply as she rolls up my sleeve and preps me for my flu shot. That's a very nice muscle you have there. Really? I say, surprised. It's funny you're saying that, because just yesterday, someone told me how weak I am. Nah, trust me. You can go tell that friend of yours they don't know what they're talking about. The nurse laughs and then dabs my shoulder with an alcohol swab. I eye the needle in her hand and take a deep breath. Seconds later, the nurse jabs my left shoulder with the needle. I wince and curl my toes, trying to keep a straight face as the stinging and burning sensation curse through my body. Perfect, you are all set. The nurse applies a band-aid where the needle pierced my skin. In green letters it reads, I was brave. I walk through the Erin Mills Town Center parking lot, trying to remember where I parked our silver Dodge. I put my sunglasses on and smile. I pull out my BlackBerry from the pocket of my leather jacket and text Michael. So, I went to get my flu shot, and the lady said I have a very nice muscle. Ha! See, I am not a weakling after all. I spot the Dodge and make my way towards it. As I climb into the 4x4, my phone beeps. I smile when I see that Michael texted back. The mini workout on those monkey bars yesterday must have performed wonders. My hand covers my mouth as I let a giggle slip. I lean back into the seat and sigh. I clasp the phone to my chest with both my hands. Michael's text still shines through on the screen. I close my eyes and replay yesterday in my mind. I picked up Michael from the instructional building at the University of Toronto, Mississauga. How was your trip up here? I asked and hugged him, my head barely reaching his chest. Not too bad, Michael responded and hugged me back. Warmth surged through my body at the sound of his deep voice. I imagined a steaming mug of thick, hot chocolate sending heat into my cold fingertips as I sat in front of a kindling fireplace, looking out the window, watching the snow fall from a navy blue sky. I hugged him a second longer. We laughed and talked our way across the UTM campus, through the parking lot, down the slope leading to the forest, across the little wooden bridge over the streaming river, and finally into Erindale Park. "Would you think I'm silly if I told you I wanted to go on the swings?" I said, craning my neck to look at Michael. "I see no reason why your desire to swing should be seen as anything less than endearing, Rowan," he replied. I laughed at his choice of words and hopped on the black swing dangling by metal chains. Michael started pushing me from behind. The swing carried me higher and higher into the sky. My heart seemed to fly upward towards the gray clouds. The sun shone like an enormous gold coin. With every shove of his hand into the small of my back, the rest of the world slipped out of my mind. Michael sat down on the swing next to me. We talked. I never took my eyes off his. The color of his eyes took me back to what I saw when I looked over the balcony of my bedroom in Alexandria. They were the color of the October sea, sometimes green, sometimes blue, with specks of gold around the black pupils, as if the sun permanently cast its reflection on them. Michael's wide eyes had a bit of home. We talked about our childhoods, how Michael's mother took him swinging in the Portuguese market downtown Toronto while she did her grocery shopping, how my father took me swimming in the Mediterranean Sea every weekend in Alexandria back in Egypt. We talked about how his passion for math led him to studying engineering, and how my love for my country drove me into politics. We talked about our love for music, guitar, politics, and the arts. We talked about old friends. We discovered that, like my father, Michael carries handkerchiefs instead of paper tissue. When I challenged his strength, Michael leapt off his swing and scooped me off mine and into his arms. A laugh escaped me as I held tight to his neck, my face buried in his chest. He carried me over to the monkey bars, one strong arm wrapped around my back and the other in the groove of the back of my knees. I swung my legs back and forth. His chuckles filled my head. He held me tight, and when he set me down, he did not let my hand go. We did not kiss. We strolled hand in hand alongside the Credit River. Michael's hand was almost twice the size of mine. It swallowed my hand whole. I had never let a guy hold my hand before. "Your hands are cold," I said. "You know what they say about people with cold hands," Michael responded, his lips curving into a smile. "What?" I said, turning my brain over for the answer. "They have warm hearts." I grasped his hand tighter as our fingers intertwined. My phone beeps again. Another text from Michael. "Will you be on Skype this evening?" "Yes," I text back. I start the Dodge and drive out of the Erin Mills Center parking lot. I merge onto the 403 highway and make my way to our condo on Hur Ontario Street. In my room, I pick up my guitar and play a few songs by the Pierces and Flunk before I sit down and attempt to write my philosophy essay. I check the time, I sweat for an hour on the elliptical in the gym, and I chat away with my best friend Sarah for another hour and a half on Skype. I check the time. I bake a chocolate cake for my brother and sketch henna designs with Arabic calligraphy on the back of a brown paper bag. I check the time. I tear the cellophane wrap off a fresh canvas, squeeze out green, blue, and ochre on my palette, and start a new painting. I check the time. I do not pick up the phone and text Michael until he has texted me, saying he will be on Skype shortly. Michael calls and starts talking about his day. I open video call and show him the painting I'm working on, green, blue, and gold, like the colors of his eyes. "Rowan," do I sense a change in his tone? "Let's talk." "Say it. Ask me out. Say it." "So you have a thing for me?" I hear Michael's quiet, nervous laughter. I bite down on my lip and try not to smile too widely. "Yes?" I find myself asking rather than saying. "Rowan, I have enjoyed the past few days very much, and I have been giving much thought into pursuing a relationship with you." My heart plays an African drum rhythm inside my chest. In my head, tiny figures dance around an anticipated victory. But I think I shouldn't pursue a relationship with you. Silence. I can't move. I can't speak. I can't breathe. I know I've been giving you mixed signals, but that is only because, up until this morning, I was on the edge about whether I wanted to abandon our friendship and risk losing what we already have. Think again, I want to yell, but I don't. I'm sorry. A thick black curtain falls around me. Michael's tone becomes sincere, apologetic. He hesitates at points, and sometimes I hear him take a deep breath before his warm voice fills the room again. I don't want things to be awkward between us. My mind is there, and I enjoy giving you affection and receiving it from you, but I'm not sure my heart is entirely there. My lips glue together. I don't want you to end up heartbroken. I'm Portuguese. You're Egyptian. You will only end up being hurt. I pick up my brush and dip it in orange paint. I'm flattered to be your first crush, Rowan. I start scratching away at the canvas. You are endearing, intelligent, kind, and I enjoy your company immensely. Petals, flowers, red, orange, and yellow, fire. I still want to make you laugh because I love hearing you laugh. I don't cry. I don't plead. I don't even frown. Instead, I nod here and there and assure him that I am perfectly fine when he risks asking me if I am. You are multitasking again, Michael says after a pause. I'm just painting, I say, dipping my brush in turpentine. You are painting, talking to me, fighting with your thoughts, sorting out your emotions, and keeping a brave face. Michael lets out a little laugh. I laugh along and shake my head. No wonder I fell for him. I tell him that I need to go because my mother needs my help with something. What she would need my help with at 2 in the morning escapes me. Michael doesn't ask either. Take care, Habibti. He still calls me darling. I shut down my laptop and set it on my desk. I wash out my brushes and put away the paint. I take the half-finished painting of an orange carnation on a green, blue, and ochre background and set it outside on the balcony to dry. I close the door to my bedroom and change into my pink polka dot pajamas. I look in the mirror and notice the band-aid on my shoulder from the flu shot I took what seems like a million years ago. The edges are slightly curled. I read the green letters printed on the band-aid. I was brave. I rip the band-aid off my shoulder and cry.
That was I Was Brave, written and read by Rowan El-Shabessy. In tonight's second story, a daughter, literally, fills the hole between her brother and mother after a violent dispute over his report card. Let's listen now as Rowan El-Shabessy reads her story, Brother.
Brother, by Rowan El-Shabessy. My brother stands, fists clenched to his side, in the middle of our living room. Head bowed, his ears turn a brilliant shade of red. My mother sits on a brown couch, bathed in the sunlight that falls through the window. She crosses her legs and folds her hands across her chest. Mother stares down, brother. I trusted that you knew what you were doing, that you had grown up, that you understood what lies at stake, mother says in a calm, steady voice. I'm sorry, brother says automatically and in a flat tone. He stuffs his hands in his pockets and rolls his eyes. It's just this one test. I promise I will never fail again. You promise that you will not fail? Mother raises her voice slightly. Young man, you take those hands out of those pockets and you listen to me. You listen very closely. Brother sighs. He throws his head back and stares at the ceiling. His nose flares as he slowly pulls out his hands of the pockets of his shorts and clenches them back into fists. You are not making an effort, Mother says. We come all the way over here to Canada. We live away from our families, away from your father, so that you and your sister can have a good, respectable education and be something. Yes, yes, I know, Brother says, as if he is bored. No, no, you do not know, Mother gawks at Brother. If you had any idea how much effort and time we are putting into providing you with this life, with this opportunity that others can only dream of, I would not be looking at a high school report where my son has barely passed English. I said, I'm sorry, khalas, enough. A vein on Brother's forehead throbs. When you make an action, you cannot control how others react to it. Now I am the one who will decide when it is enough. Mother's big almond-shaped light brown eyes widen. She raises an eyebrow. Brother's fists unclench as he lets out a long sigh. Now, Mother says and lifts up her chin slightly. Choose your punishment. I look at her and give my head a little shake. It's none of your business, Ronnie, Mother snaps at me when she sees the expression on my face. I'm sure you don't like seeing your brother fail us as well as himself. As for you, young man, she says, turning to Brother, you will sit down right here in front of me. You will pick up one of your sister's university political textbooks, and you will read a chapter a day. You will answer the questions at the back of the chapters, and you will answer them in writing. If you fail to do so, I will forbid you from going out with your friends. If I do not see that you are putting in enough effort, I will come up with further punishments. But not another word, Mother interrupts. She picks up an Arabic novel from the coffee table and places it open-faced on a flower-print burgundy cushion that sits on her lap. She puts on her reading glasses, her soft black hair falling over her face. In a slow, controlled movement, Brother moves his chair away from the dining table and prepares to sit down. I hand him my Introduction to Comparative Politics textbook and shrug. I reach up and pat his soft black hair. Read out loud, Mother says without looking up from her book. What? I want to hear that voice of yours when you read out the chapter. Mother's eyes do not move from the page she pretends to read. Why? Because I said so. Fine, Mother, Brother says through gritted teeth. His chest heaves as he takes in a long breath and forces his eyes shut. Make sure you read clearly, will you? Mother keeps her eye on the same page of her book. I do not want to have to make you repeat. Brother stands still for a second, his knees still bent, ready to sit. But his body contracts and freezes. His ears turn a brilliant shade of purplish red, like a young plum on a tree. His jaw clenches and the vein on his forehead throbs again. Brother's right hand forms a fist so tight that his knuckles turn the colors of the white clouds I spot outside the living room window. Brother springs back up to his full 6 feet. He swings his arm back and flexes his muscles, and in one swift movement, he punches the wall. His fist lands with a loud crack into the pastel yellow drywall. Brother topples over his chair, strides towards his room, and slams the door shut, the glass panes threatening to shatter as they shake. I hold my breath and dare to look at Mother. Her eyes widen to the size of teacup saucers. He punched the wall, Mother whispers, because I need to do that too, He ruined the wall, and now I have to take care of that too. She takes her glasses off and buries her face in her hands. Perfect, she says and looks up, her nose turning pink. Mother slowly gets up from the couch, sets aside the cushion, positions the book on the coffee table, and paces towards her room. She shuts the door behind her. I look around the deserted square living room. To my right, Mother's glasses, book, and cushion lie abandoned on the couch. To my left, the dining table stands coated in a thin film of dust and paint chips. The gaping hole in the wooden walls shows a perfect imprint of my brother's fist. I stare ahead at the two shut doors that stand side by side, separating me from my brother and my mother. I hesitate for a second and then stride towards my brother's room. I knock. I don't usually knock. He doesn't respond. I push open the door. My chest tightens as I see my muscular, broad-shouldered brother kneeling on an olive-green rug in prayer, his big hands raised to the sky. His big almond-shaped eyes shut tight. His strong back, which he trained himself to hold straight through hours of water polo practice and excruciating workouts at the gym, hunched like a 90-year-old man's in need of a cane for support. I stand so, one head holding the doorknob, and watch. Brother opens his eyes, and I catch him with mine. His eyes seem to have shrunk to half their size. Brother takes in a short, quick breath and breaks into tears. I kneel down on the prayer rug and wrap my arms around him. Brother buries his face in my shoulder, and his hands clench my sweatshirt. I rock him back and forth and run my fingers through his hair, the way I did when we were children. I soothe him and kiss him on the forehead like I did the day, years ago, when he fell off the swings and cut his knee. I hug my baby brother as tight as my arms allow me. His tears seep through the fabric of my sweatshirt. I blink back my own tears as his sobs grow softer. I'm so sorry, Ronnie, my baby brother croaks. I kiss the top of his head and rest my chin on his soft black curls. You know what to do, baby, I say and pat him on the back. Brother quietly stands up and wipes his face. He folds away the prayer rug and places it at the foot of his bed. He strides out of the bedroom and knocks on Mother's door. I follow. Come in, Mother says. Brother opens the door and enters. Mother sits on the edge of the bed, her eyes damp. I'm so sorry, Mommy, Brother says, his voice feeble. Mother looks at Brother, and her eyes fill with tears. She stands and opens her arms wide. Brother bends down and embraces her. Tears stream down his face. Mother stands on tiptoes, hugs him, and rubs his back. It's okay, sweetheart, Mother coos. It's okay. I back out of the room and shut the door behind me. I walk to the living room and straighten the cushions on the couch. I take a damp cloth and wipe the surface of the dining table clean of dust, flaked paint, and wood splinters. A little later, Mother and Brother amble out of the room. We're going out for ice cream, she says. Mother ties a gray scarf around her neck, then pauses and looks at me. Don't tell your father. She flicks one end of her scarf over her shoulder. I nod and smile as they each grab their coats and head towards the apartment front door. Brother eyes the hole in the wall and looks to the floor. His face reddens. Brother kisses my cheeks, and he walks out of the condo. I walk into the laundry room and take out quick dry cement, sandpaper, roller brushes, and the bucket of paint that remained from the paint job we did last fall. The label on the bucket reads eggshell. I find a thick sheet of cardboard in my room that I had bought a couple of weeks ago and thought would come in handy for an arts project. I place the material on the dining room table and study the hole in the wall. I trace the edges of the hole with my fingers. The perfect imprint of my brother's knuckles looks like a skyline of mountains and hills against a thicket of yellow clouds. Perfect. An absolutely perfect, strong punch. I cut out the cardboard and glue it into the inside of the wall, and then apply the quick, dry cement. For the next hour, I smooth out the surface with sandpaper, scratching my fingertips raw. I paint coat upon generous coat of eggshell over the white patch of cement. I open the windows to allow the fresh air in and let the paint dry. 4 hours later, mother and brother walk into the condo, laughing and chatting. I had so much chocolate fudge ice cream. It's insane, brother says. I laugh and hug him. Brother walks into his room and turns on music. Lil Wayne's rapping vibrates through the apartment walls. Mother looks at the dining room wall and jerks her head back. She looks at me and smiles. Thank you, honey, she says and cups my cheeks. I love you, Mommy, I say. I love you way more, baby. Mother hugs me. I hug her back. My eyes focus on the blotch of paint, still damp and glistening, on the wall.
That was Brother, read and written by Rowan El-Shabessy. This concludes Life Rattle number 1279. My name is John Dunford. Lori Callis recorded Rowan El-Shabessy reading her stories. Life Rattle was created by Guy Allen and Arnie Ackman. Be sure to tune in next Thursday to hear more new stories.